Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I will be your host. I'm joined today with my good friend, Doug Hagerman. Hey, Doug.
Good. Got my name right today. It's awesome. I've only known you for how long, and we're finally getting it right. Of course, that only puts you in the 1% of everybody I talk to. So congratulations. Welcome to the top 1% here.
Thank you. Maybe you can sign me up for a class for how to take the marbles out of your mouth.
I'd hate to say it there, but I got my own marbles to deal with, man. So I can't help you on that one. That comes way too frequently for me to be an expert.
So this week we have, once again, we have our very own Kelly Coughlin. How are you doing today, Kelly?
I'm fine. Do you guys want me to talk with marbles in my mouth so you can't hear me, or do you want me to articulate for you?
You're an accountant, Kelly. I need you to be as clear as possible.
Nice to see both of you.
Good. Well, glad to have you on, Kelly. So we're having Kelly on again once for the 5-minute tax tip of the week and want to get everybody set for tax season. So we brought on Kelly. So Kelly, what do you got for us this week?
Well, I want to first state that none of the tax tips that we talk about on this show should be considered to be tax advice for your audience. If you want specific tax advice, get help from an expert like me, I suppose, but this is not specific tax advice.
Got it.
All right. So in today's tax tip, I wanted to try something different, Kirk, but you kind of hammered on me before saying, come on, Kelly, make it more interesting and exciting. Tell some stories, do something better. So with that in mind, I'm going to try a new high-tech tool to demonstrate this. You know how Karl Rove uses the whiteboard for his political analysis? And that's kind of become his brand a little bit, his whiteboard. Well, I'm here with announcing my new brand approach to demonstrating tax tips, and that's the white paddle.
Interesting.
Very easy. Hardest thing is to write the words so you can read them. That's the most challenging thing. So I'm going to use this gadget as the tool here. Does that work for your sophisticated audience?
We got a few high fives already,
yeah.
So go ahead.
That's the most reaction we've gotten in a while. So I think this paddle is going over well. I'm not sure if people are a little excited about where we're going with the paddle, though, but keep going.
I could take it to my wife over there and, well, never mind.
Yeah, we got to keep it G-rated.
Keep it G-rated.
Or at least PG-13.
Right? Okay, all right. So here's today's tax tip. Ready? Today, we got two things going on in the world today. It's the shared economy and passive income. Shared economy, as all of us know, your audience knows, is really it's taking an asset that you own and trying to figure out how you can generate some revenue and profit out of it. It could be you rent it out to others. It could be you use it in your own enterprise. So that's the shared economy phenomenon. The other part is passive income. Everybody's into this. How can I make money and not really have to work for it? It's where these two come together is what my tax tip is going to be related. The tax tip isn't necessarily limited to just the shared economy, but it tends to be where things come together. So with that in mind, here's what I'm going to talk about very briefly, because you only give me 5 minutes to talk about a complex tax topic. ACL and PPE. You probably think ACL is what?
I don't know. It sounds like something Joe Biden would say with that word salad that you just said. So I don't know. What is it?
Sounds as painful as a broken ligament in my knee.
There you go. Anterior cruciate ligament tear. And if you had said that, you know what I haven't said, Doug? Wrong.
Tell me what it is, Kelly, because I'm clearly way off base here.
Active Schedule C loss. And PPE means, and accountants refer to PPE as property, plant, and equipment. And if you had said that, you know what I've said, Kirk?
Correct?
Wrong.
Ah.
Passive Schedule E profits. Okay? There they are. So what does this tip mean? The tip here is while you are incubating let's just say it's a new idea. Frequently, these new ideas can be in the shared economy. Let's say you're thinking about doing Airbnb or Uber or any type of business that you're incubating. In those early years, when you're generating a loss, that's the ACL, that's the L in loss, you want that to be an active business on your Schedule C. And the reason is you can reduce your other income, your other taxable income by taking that loss. pretty much unrestricted. On the other hand, if you're doing rentals or passive type activities, those appear on your Schedule E, and those are subject to, the losses are subject to other kind of tax rules that eliminate your ability to take full tax advantage of them. So the idea is here, when you have a loss in a new venture, let's say it's a new, you're incubating a new idea, make sure it gets on your Schedule C. It's an active business. It'll reduce your taxable income. It'll reduce your taxes. But once it gets kind of incubated and it's successful, the next move is to try to get it over to a passive business where it's generating profits there. And those profits aren't subject to self-employment tax. That's the beauty is, now you can't just, you know, kind of randomly willy-nilly decide this first 2 years, I'm going to put it in Schedule A. Next, you can't do that. But what you can do is create your business model around this strategy, and then you implement tactics to make sure that it legally, legitimately, validly can morph from Schedule C, where you recognize loss, reduce taxable income, taxes, et cetera, get it over to your Schedule E. It may mean that you step out of the management of it. There's a lot of ways that you can do that. You change your, let's say in the Schedule C, it's a, you know, there's one guy that we helped do this. He was going to do like a Airbnb. Well, he was going to take a loss the first couple of years. So we had him get more involved in the cooking breakfast, you know, B&B used to be bed and breakfast in Ireland and England, right? So offer breakfast is more of hotel type thing. That way you're actively participating in it. Takes a loss, reduces the taxable income by $20,000, $25,000, I think that year, saved a boatload of taxes. Then he looked at it and said, this is crazy. I got a lot of income. I don't want to wake up and do breakfast for 20 people every week. I'm going to peel back the breakfast thing, turn it into more of a passive operation, remove the breakfast part of it, then try, there's a couple other things we had to do, but get out of the active participation management of it, get into the passive part of it, goes from a Schedule C, where it reduces taxable income, to a Schedule E, generates income, passive income that's not subject to self-employment tax. It's a home run. It takes some work. It takes smart people like me that you have to pay a lot of money to help get it done.
That's awesome, Kelly. Well, I appreciate that sentiment. We have a lot of business owners, and I think they'll appreciate that. Active business losses, Schedule C, and Schedule E is passive business gains. So awesome. Appreciate that. Love the paddle. That's a good visual. That's awesome. Well, Kelly, appreciate you coming on the show once again. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. I know you got a lot of clients to head off to. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. I hope I didn't go over my allotted time.
You're good. We'll see you next week. All right, Doug, we had an episode last week on deflation, and I can't remember the last time I got so much hate mail and love mail at the same time. I have a love-hate relationship with my listeners now, Doug, here. They had a lot of hate mail. People were like, what the hell? You've been telling us for inflation for the last year, and now you're talking about deflation. Like, what are you losing your mind? I mean, just some of the things I got. I'm still laughing at some of the comments I got. I want to kind of talk about it a little bit, and we're going to share some charts here this week. But you were here last week, obviously. So what are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, first thing I want to say, and again, that's interesting. You got that love-hate relationship. I think a lot of people, social media celebrities, I'll call it, talking heads, get a lot of flack about opinions and things that they state. That, you know, people will be quick to come back and show them a screenshot from a year or two ago or 5 years ago saying, you said this. Well, that's the beauty of the world we live in, is that as new data comes in, things can change. If it was static, you wouldn't need to talk about any of this. Obviously, 6-7% inflation is not something we were talking about 4 years ago. So that changed. And now we came to a situation where we had, you know, 6-7% inflation. Well, now with whatever reasons that are causing it, whether it's all of the stuff that the Federal Reserve is trying to do and implementing and raising interest rates, or whether or not other variables and data have come to play, all of a sudden, we're starting to see those interest rates come down. Maybe inflation's cooling off a little bit. And of course, things can flip alternately into a situation where now we're going to end up in a deflationary environment. And that's what the 70s were, right? The 70s had a lot of stagflation. We had this economy that was just kind of trying to break out and do something that in a normal environment should not create inflation, because during that circumstance, we should not have enough demand against supply to create that inflation. Well, guess what? We had a lack of supply there that was more egregious than the drop off in demand. Hence, we had stagnation along with inflation, especially looking at the oil embargoes. We're running into similar things like this now, as we talked about what's going on with the bullwhip effect. So I just bought a safe the other day, and this safe is normally about $600, $650 prior to COVID. And then all of a sudden, COVID came, supply chain interruption. I tried to find that same safe. They didn't even carry it anymore because they couldn't get it at that pricing. Other safes were coming in at like $1,500 to $2,000, Kirk. Okay.
Wow.
For similar. It's like, all right, well, guess what? This month, that same, now it's not exactly the same safe. This is kind of like shrinkflation a little bit, but that was a 75-minute rated safe, which meant that it would be able to withstand water and fire for 75 minutes. Now they are offering one for the same price. That's a 60 minute. So it's lost a little bit of that integrity. They shrinkflated it a little bit. And now on top of that, they had a sale for $150 off. So this safe was now going for $525. It finally came back down. That was a bullwhip effect issue. But look what's going on with chicken eggs right now. Again, all of a sudden we had the bird flu. The price of chicken eggs absolutely exploded. Now we've got another fire going on in a processing plant that caused the price of chicken eggs to go up even higher or may continue. We've got orange juice. We've got lots of things that are affected by weather issues and the hurricanes in Florida last year that we knew were going to be a problem. But as those things start to play themselves out and we start to free up the supply chain, we're running into issues in which it could go ultimately the other direction, because the problem with the bullwhip is when you need it and it's not there, the price spikes. When you then see that price spiking and you no longer are willing to pay that price, then consumer demand starts to shift. They may drive less. They may eat less eggs, drink less orange juice. And all of a sudden that demand plummets. Guess what happens? Deflation. You actually have a situation that by the time they have enough eggs and enough orange juice and enough safes and enough this, now there's an oversupply. We are so far from seeing the end of this incredibly volatile bullwhip effect, Kirk, that it is going to be a different of conversation, not just year to year, but week to week, month to month. We might be in an inflationary environment this week, and 5 weeks later, it could be completely deflationary or vice versa.
One of the challenges that people have a hard time with is, you know, let's think about it. Some of the most influential people in the investment or personal finance industry. You know, you think of who those people are. You think of like a Robert Kiyosaki. You think of like Peter Schiff. You think of people like that, that are very much, they have a single tune. They sing the same tune. Like Peter Schiff has been saying, dollar's going to go to zero and you got to buy gold for 20 years. And even if the trend is going against what he's saying, he's still saying, he's still beating the same drum. And it's like, dude, like, what's wrong with you? You're like a band that has one note. And what good are you if that's the case, right?
Kirk,
the
clock's right twice a day.
That's right. Well, in his case, maybe once a day. But if you think about...
Or a decade.
Yeah, or a decade, yeah. I mean, so if you think about, there's a lot of people out there that have a single tune. They're permabulls, they're permabears, they're gold bugs, they're whatever. Yeah, everyone's got their tune, and that's okay. So you have to understand the people you're talking with. Now, if you're talking to a gold bug, you need to know you're talking to a gold bug. If it's the wrong time to buy gold and you're following this person and they're saying buy gold, then it's on you. So you have a choice. Here's how you think about it, right? It's a mental model. People are looking for advice. There's a lot of people following the show and they're listening because they want advice. They want to learn how to think about things better. That's what we're really good at in the show, is mental models and how to think about investing. We're not telling you what to think. I'm not saying go buy this, go sell this. I couldn't do that. I don't know everybody's situation. The best I can do is teach you how to think, and then you can make good decisions. So if you think about it, if you're following me or Robert Kiyosaki, Peter Schiff, or any of these people that are professionals, they're experts, if you're following them, you need to understand who you're following. Are they a one-note instrument or are they an orchestra? If you're listening to somebody and they're saying the same thing every day, you don't know if what they're saying is right or wrong. In their industry, it might be right. So if you're listening to a gold bug and they're saying, well, buy this coin versus that coin, okay, I will take their word for it because I've already made the decision I'm going to buy a gold coin. This person knows which one I should buy. Okay, that's a good decision. But if you're just going to a gold bug and saying, should I buy gold? Yes, you should buy gold. They're not going to say, no, you should buy race cars. That's not what they do. But for somebody like Doug and I, or there's a few others, we're actually going to change our mind because the facts change. think it was John Maynard Keynes was falsely quoted many times when they says, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? I don't think he actually said that, but I think that the quote is actually probably more concise than what he would have said. And it makes a lot of sense. Look, when the facts change, I change my mind. Well, here's a situation of the facts changing. We've been beating the drum on the last year and a half of inflation. Been telling everybody about inflation. It's a problem. No one really paid attention until like the latter part of the year. And they're like, oh my God, inflation, it's a problem. My eggs are up 300%. Well, that's fine, but you should have been listening earlier. And now last week we came out and said, well, deflation is now potentially going to be a problem. And we laid out our case and we told you exactly why it's potentially going to be a problem. What do we get? Hate mail. You're not an inflationist. You know, you think that government's printing money and the dollar is going to go to zero and hyperinflation and blah, 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 blah. Okay, I've heard that argument and that argument makes sense. And we've laid it out for a year on the show. That is one scenario. That is a scenario. If the government has low interest rates for a long time and we have high inflation, it's going to turn to hyperinflation. Totally agree. Let's all agree on that. That is a scenario that could happen. Is that going to happen? That's probably the least likely scenario that's going to happen. Could it? Yes. Is it probably? Improbable. And we laid out another scenario. What else could happen? Well, the other scenario is the government says, we don't like that scenario, which is true. That's the worst case scenario. So we don't like that. So what's a better scenario, but still bad? Well, we could go to the other end of the spectrum and say, all right, we're going to attack inflation by raising rates, which is what they're doing. And then we're going to let that inflation die down through higher rates. Well, okay, that seems easy. Yeah, it's easy, but it's also going to send the economy into recession. Oh, well, that's bad too. Yeah, it's bad, but it's still better than hyperinflation. However, along with that also could come the specter of deflation, which is what we're talking about. Now, deflation, it's not the worst problem. Hyperinflation is the worst problem. Deflation is second. It's second worst problem. And it's not bad in itself. I think anybody who's a fan of responsible monetary policy will say they would rather have deflation, because deflation is how you allow the system to reset itself. Look at Japan. They've been in deflation for 33 years, and they're just starting to kind of come out of it, but they've had a big problem. But they've actually addressed it reasonably well, even though their monetary system's kind of a mess. But they've handled it for 30 years, where they had really high inflation. Now they have deflation for 30 years. They're still plugging along. It's not awesome, but they're still doing okay. So if you look at that and say, well, that's a real problem too. Yes, it's a problem, but it's still better than hyperinflation because you still have an operating system. Hyperinflation means that nobody trusts the government's currency. Well, think about what you're going to do if they don't trust the dollar bill. I don't know. What are you going to use? Gold coins to go buy a loaf of bread at the store? Well, I don't have gold coins that are that small. Like, there's just practical problems. So it all sounds good on the surface, but when you break it down, it's really all impractical.
Now, Kirk, I've got some Goldschlager if you need some. I can probably let that evaporate and scrape some out of the bottle for you.
Doug, why are you hoarding this? Why didn't you tell me this earlier? We talked about this, Doug. No hiding things from me.
Hey, I also want to add in there, because something you said, like, if people are coming back saying, look, they're printing money, it's going to be inflation. We've talked about that too. Printing money does not cause inflation. We've seen this. If printing money in a vacuum caused inflation, why was there no inflation following 2008 to present? It didn't occur, because as long as that money was being printed and reabsorbed into the system, then the supply of money met the demand for goods and it was being reinvested. The reason we have inflation now all goes back to kind of what was artificially created by COVID. It comes back to a situation where money was just printed in mass amounts and nobody had the ability to buy anymore. Nobody had the ability to produce anymore. Nobody had the ability to create this stuff, which then created a lack of supply against an increased demand based on money that people had. And by the way, I also want to say we've had deflation during this entire time in certain areas. Remember, inflation and deflation can not only be on a micro level, but they can also be on a macro level. So if you're in the United States and you're looking at 7% inflation or 8% inflation, and you're seeing everything go up, well, guess what? To you, that's inflation. But deflation is also can be caused by a reduction of money supply or the increasing amount of value of your dollar and the increased buying power of your money against other goods. So guess what? In a way, the strong dollar, which had been for a while incredibly strong, was a deflationary factor because it was making it so expensive to buy our goods. It was actually deflating the ability of the companies here trying to sell in US dollars to be able to sell their goods. And so all of these variables are like a soup, and the ingredients can change all the time. Nothing happens in a vacuum. And a lot of people, as we've talked about before, Kirk, are following half-truths. Printing money, does it lead to inflation? Yes, it can, but there's more to it.
Hey, Doug, did you hear? We're giving away free money. Well, I'll tell you about it in a bit. There's a saying in the mining community. Well, precious metals mining, that is. The saying is that if you want the best deals, you have to be in the room. Now, you're probably thinking, what does it mean to be in the room? Well, I'll tell you. Being in the room means that you're on the short list of people who get invited to be a part of the best deals. These are the deals that most investors will never have access to. You mean like IPOs? Nope. IPOs are chump change. Those are for retail investors, small potatoes. That's nothing compared to these deals. These deals would have you salivating to get access to them. Once you know they exist, you will never look at investing the same way again. I almost don't want to tell you they exist because it'll ruin your thinking of how the investing world really works. Now, you might be excited that these deals exist, but you only have access to the deals if you're an insider or in the room, as they call it. As loyal listeners of the show, I'm going to give you a chance to be in the room. Money Tree Investing Podcast has created the Insiders Club. This is a community of our show's members who are loyal listeners of the show and want to get more out of their investing experience. Being a part of the Insiders Club gives you insider status for upcoming events and private webinars, discounts, free stuff and books, and influence on the future direction of the show. This is an opportunity to join us as we expand our content and services. Oh, did I mention you're getting free money? Yes, in the next few weeks, I will be giving free money to members of the Insiders Club as my appreciation for listening to the show. There's no cost to join the Insiders Club. Just go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Do that today to join the community. That's moneytreepodcast.com/free money. I hope to see you in the room.
The whole point is, as Doug was saying, we have this soup. We have both. And I'll give you an example here in a moment. If you think about where we were for pretty much a year and a half, really starting in 2021 in the summer, we had high inflation. It's when it really started to pick up, and we had it for about a year and a half, and now it's starting to come down. I don't know if it'll go below 5%. As it's kind of come down, it's come down a little quicker. So my marker was 5, but as we talk about in the show right now, is we're open to changing our minds. If you have a fixed mindset about investing, then you're an idiot. And I don't mean the listeners, because you follow people who are fixed mindset. I do this one thing. Everything, I'm a hammer. Everything's a nail. That's okay as long as you take that into consideration. Don't follow somebody off a cliff because they're a nail. You have to understand who you're following. If somebody is adaptable and agile in their thinking and willing to say, I'm not saying I'm wrong. I'm saying that the facts are changing. I mean, we're so far ahead of the curve with what we're talking about and have been for the last 2 years. It's going to confuse a lot of people, but we're trying to give you as much advance warning as possible because it took us 9 months to convince half our audience that inflation was a real deal and this paradigm shift is happening. And I don't blame them. I'm not saying that to mean like people are thick-headed. I mean that this is such a big concept, it's hard to understand, which is why we're doing what we're doing. We have this extra show a week because I know how complex this is. It took me 6 months sitting thinking about how to actually put this into words that I could explain it simply to people. It's not simple. It's like taking a 301 economics class in a matter of like an hour. You're not going to do that. So I don't expect people to understand this, which is why we're beating the dead horse over and over, because I know repetition is one of the better ways to get this through to people. So when people send hate mail of like, you're an idiot, like you're talking about inflation, now it's deflation, I understand where that comes from. But what you need to understand, for those of you who are thinking that way, is that things are changing. We talk about in the show, remember, go back to the episode we talked about the bullwhip effect, as Doug just mentioned. The bullwhip effect is effectively where prices elevate substantially, and then they decline substantially. And then the next wave is they go even more higher. So think of lumber. Lumber went from like 250, some odd, I'm just ballparking, 250 up to like 700. Then it went back to 225. Then it went to 1400. Then it went back to like 200. So you have this oscillating price.
And guess what's going back up again, Kirk?
We're going to talk about that. if you look at some of these prices, you're probably looking at your daily life and saying, hey, I go to the store, it's costing me more to buy food, or it's costing me more to fill my gas tank. What you're not thinking about is necessarily the cost of housing for your neighbor, because it doesn't affect you. So you see what affects you. And you're thinking, we have inflation because prices are through the roof. Yeah, but it doesn't affect everybody equally. Some people have different inflation factors. So what I want to address is this, and I'm going to go into some examples here to show you exactly what I'm talking about with the bullwhip effect and deflation. So we've been talking about eggs. This is wholesale egg prices. They're kind of bopping around about $1 till 2020. Then they started to go up. They went up higher than $5. And then somewhere around late last year, now they've dropped in half. That's deflationary, because they were at a certain point. It's not technically deflationary now because it's not below that price, but it's technically disinflationary. If we get to a price lower than it was last year, then it's deflationary. But understand that when I use the term deflationary, I'm using it to describe a trend. And disinflationary is the correct word. So for those of you who are economics geeks, my apologies, but I tend to use deflation because it's more of the trend and the theme. So right now we have the bullwhip effect. And here's an example. If you look at YouTube or LinkedIn, or if you looked at our website, when the episode comes out, you'll see wholesale egg prices are in a deflationary trend or disinflationary trend. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but all the rest of my food is going up. Yeah, this is one thing. Let's look at another thing here. Orange juice, same period. Now, if you concentrate hard enough, you'll see the price going up. Hopefully you guys like that joke. Anyway, So if you look at this price chart, it's just going through the roof. And it's spiking right now at the same time that egg prices are coming down. Well, does that mean that we have inflation or deflation? Well, as you said before, we have both. We have both at the same time. Doug talked about the soup. We have two things at the same time, one going up, one going down. What does that mean? In aggregate, it means that technically we still have inflation because it's still 6.5% on the CPI. And you could argue whether that's right or not, but let's ignore that for a moment. You have two things happening at the same time. So what I'm talking about deflation, what I'm talking about is the trend. So we have a trend of inflation. Now we have a trend in the CPI of disinflation, where we still have positive inflation, but it's declining. Now, I don't think we'll get to zero, but it's quite possible by the end of the year we could, or below zero. This is what I was talking about last week. The reason it could get to zero or below zero is really two main reasons. One, because we had such a spike in prices that coming down off of that price spike could be considered deflationary, depending on when you line up the numbers. Right now, it's disinflation. We could have a deflationary spike because 42% of the CPI is housing, which, as you all know, is coming down this year. 10 to 20% is my estimate. Who knows what's going to happen, but I would guess probably 10 to 20 on average. You have all these other things that are coming down in price too. As an aggregate, I think it is quite possible by the end of the year, it could be a negative CPI print. Now, that's going to freak everybody out because you're like, no, we have inflation. Just go with me. It's possible that on paper, it could be negative. Now, the second point is actually really the coup de grace of why this could happen, which is the CPI was marked as a 24-month rolling average. As of January, it's going to be a 12-month. So what happened in June, July? Inflation peaked. Now it's coming down. So if that's the case, just think math, just think perspectives, right? You have a number that's hit its peak and now you have a lower number. Well, the lower number means it's deflationary or disinflationary. So you could hit a negative number by math's sake. Forget what's going on in the economy. Just looking at the math, looking at statistics, we could have a negative CPI print. And people are going to freak out when we're having deflation. Just understand that this is something that could happen. Does it mean inflation is going to go away? Absolutely not. We could have a soft landing. All these things are possible. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not sitting here rubbing my crystal ball and saying, oh, this is what's going to happen. No, you need to know how to think about it. So understand that this is how you should be thinking about it, is keep an open mind, keep an agile perspective on this factor. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If you're paying more for groceries, you're paying less for other goods. And that is deflationary for other goods and services. Your assets have been deflationary for the past year. Is that going to continue? I don't know. But I do know that asset prices are in deflation while goods and services have been inflation. So you just need to know that all of these levers are moving back and forth. And if you don't understand that there are different levers, it's not a single lever. There are all these different levers that are moving the economy. And Ray Dalio actually has a good video, if you haven't seen it, it's called How the Economy Works, where he talks about these little mini cycles within a grand cycle. If you understand that that's how it works, you're going to view the economy totally different. It'll change your world when it comes to investing and personal finance in your home. Doug, what are your thoughts? Since I just kind of ended my rant there for a minute, I might catch my breath.
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is I put back that egg pricing chart. I want to know where people get their eggs. Because I was just looking on Costco the other day, trying to get some eggs, and the eggs in my area are going for $3.79 a dozen.
This still is wholesale. So they're making the spread.
Now I know their profit. That's right. It wasn't written in the chart.
I know their profit.
Okay, perfect. All right. Well, and of course, you know, with that fire, who knows where it's going to go after that data. But I don't really have anything to add on to what you just said there, Kurt, because I think we were kind of tag teaming a little bit in that situation. I think there is a lot that goes in to these conversations. I think you brought up something. It's math. Unfortunately, math is something that people do not spend enough time. Math is not something that people spend enough time truly understanding. We got a good question about price fixing of oligopolies and obviously what that means to inflation. I'm going to let you address that because I think you had mentioned here. And of course, I think that to some degree, you know, that tin on your head might play something into that question. But Kirk and I were talking before we got into this that the only difference between a conspiracy theory and fact is the evidence, right? Lots of things out there that have happened that we think, wow, geez, you know, that's a conspiracy theory. These people are crazy. And then all of a sudden things came out later that said, yeah, they weren't so crazy. And I think that's what keeps people on their toes. Go back to the Tuskegee Project and just the things that have been done over history. So obviously, I don't want to get into politics here, but some of the things that have come in the news the last 365 days that were railed against as completely fraudulent, and all of a sudden things have come out that these things may have existed. I'll let you decide in your own imagination what we might be talking about here.
Let me address that really quickly, Doug, because I did put on my tinfoil hat for this conversation. Please. For those of you who are watching the video, Doug was talking about the fire at the food plant. And, you know, if you look at history, and I want to bring this up, not to get into politics, although I'll probably use some examples. If you look at history, there are a lot of people who are conspiracy theorists, and this is looked at as a pejorative, that people are conspiracy theorists. And I was actually just on the Tinfoil Hat, not the Tinfoil Hat podcast, but Sam Tripoli's other show, Cash Guys or something like that. So I was on his show, and he's the Tinfoil Hat guy. He's been on Joe Rogan a bunch of times as a comedian. And one of the fascinating things I find is that people take a hammer and they pejoratively beat people with this moniker of "you're a conspiracy theorist." Well, you're only a conspiracy theorist until you're proven right. Until then, it's a conspiracy. Realistically, I think it's a bad term because really nothing is science until it's proven true, right? Science is the process of learning and understanding and finding out what's true and what's not true. So whether it's a science experiment, whether it's some political thing, whether it's fire at a food plant or whatever, I don't know the truth. And I'm not going to sit here and say it's true or not. I don't know. But I think we all have to have an open mind to the fact that it could be. I mean, think of politics. Trump was there. How many times was he brought up under some sort of charge or some idea that he had done X and nothing ended up panning out? I don't know if it was true or not. I'm not smart enough to know that. But I know that it was a pattern. So you look at all these conspiracies and maybe some are true, some are not. I bring this up not to get down the road of conspiracy theories or politics, but to get into the fact that this is where investing comes. Like, where is the line between truth and speculation? If you're speculating that something's going to happen, you don't really know, just like a conspiracy theory. It might be true or it might not. The person who's calling you a conspiracy theorist or the person who's saying it could be true, if you knew it, then it wouldn't really be a debate. I think we can all argue that the world is not flat. Now, I'm sure some people might have some good evidence, but I don't have any. It looks round to me. But the point is for some things that are unknowable, right? It's like asking the question, does God exist? Well, it's not provable. So you're just basically arguing about something you can't prove either way. So you're just basically arguing for fun. If you have like an investment thesis, you can't prove the future until it happens, which is a similar mindset as conspiracy theories, right? Like somebody says, well, there's a claim whether January 6th was a revolution or whether it was just, you know, somebody using different terms. I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I saw it was on the news and I don't trust that anyway. So I have no idea and I'm not going to make an opinion. But because you don't know until after the fact when it was proven. Well, let's just take an investment thesis. Well, I think value stocks are going to do well this year. Okay, well, that's a thesis I have, and I'm not going to know if I was right or not until the end of the year. You could argue with me growth is going to do better or value. It's a stupid argument. So we bring this up because this stuff comes up a lot, and you need to understand how to discern between truth and narratives. Narratives are what you're being fed by kind of the mainstream media. And I'm not saying they're wrong, just saying it's a narrative. It's a story that you're being told. it could be 100% right. A narrative I'm using somewhat uses pejoratively, just like conspiracy theorists. But a narrative is also, it could be true. Like, we're telling you a story. You know, if we bring somebody on and say, here's a story of a client that we went through and we talked through that, that's a narrative. It doesn't mean that it's true or not true. It happens to be true, but it's still a narrative. So we just need to understand that the narratives are there to provide illustration on a point and to help to drive it home. And we as human beings love stories. So we look at a narrative and say, well, it must be true. Well, I don't know. I mean, Aesop's fables weren't true, but they certainly prove a point. So I want to take my tinfoil hat off in a moment. I want to talk about, actually, I should probably leave it on for this question.
Leave it on for that one question, because I also want to say one really important thing. I don't want to hijack your response there, but this comes back to also understanding and really focusing. It's hard to, because we get caught up in the emotion. And if this is happening, it's working against me. It's kind of fun to have that kind of emotional response to things that are around you. But there is what we can control and what we can't control. The reality is there price fixing? Maybe. Is there fires at egg plants that are happening on purpose? I've seen a lot about this. The produce, the meat processors and the eggs, they're being set on fire to drive these prices up. Maybe they are. The reality is there's nothing we can do about it. You've got to be able to make decisions within the realm of what you can control. And what you can control is what the majority of the masses are going to have available to them. So when you start to get muddied up into that kind of what ifs scenarios, all it's going to probably lead you to do is freeze up and not take enough action in the areas that we can control. So that's just a thought there. Go ahead, Kirk.
All right, I appreciate it, Doug. So I'm leaving this tinfoil hat on to answer a listener question, which is what to do against price fixing by oligopolies, which obviously contributes to inflation. Great question. I'm not leaving this tinfoil hat on for the person asking the question, but more for the fact that oligopolies, you need a tinfoil hat to be able to address. So what is an oligopoly? Let's look at the spectrum, right? So the spectrum is on one end is monopolies. So monopolies is when you have one single firm that owns all the business of that industry. Think of an example. I'm trying to think of a good example, Doug. There are so very few nowadays, but
AT&T is a perfect example of that.
All right. So AT&T. So if you think of AT&T in the old days, it was the only carrier. There's only one telephone company. Perfect example. In my area, in my town, Comcast is the only internet and cable provider allowed in the town. That is a monopoly. The reason that happened is they paid the town extra money so that they could be the only carrier, which means that the town basically screwed the residents for the sake of their own budget. So effectively, the residents get screwed. I hate Comcast. They suck. Like, I hate to say that. No, I don't hate to say it. The whole experience is terrible. Every time I call, it's terrible. Everything about them is terrible. And yet they've price fixed effectively the prices and the service, because they don't care if they service me because no one else can come in and do it better. So that's a monopoly. Comcast has a monopoly in my town for hardline internet based and cable service. Okay. Now, an oligopoly means there's a handful of companies that do it. So an example of an oligopoly would be OPEC, oil producing countries. So you got Saudi Arabia, you got Russia, you got, you know, now you got the US, although they're not OPEC. I think Nigeria is in there, if I'm not mistaken, but there's a whole bunch of OPEC countries. And Venezuela. They all get together and they have like a meeting, you know, at some cool location, and they talk and they're like, all right, what should the price fixed be today? And they say, all right, it should be $75. All right, it's $75. And they all basically manage the supply and demand around $75. Now, as a group, they have a lot of responsibility to the consumer. The consumer, they need to fuel their car. And if it costs $500 a gallon to fuel their car, they're going to go find another solution. But if it costs a dollar to fill their car, well, these people don't make as much money. So they're going to find a balance in the middle that is appealing for customers to not change their habits. Now, the problem is because they're an oligopoly, they have a lot of power. And as you've seen with Biden, when Trump was over there, there was some back and forth with Saudi Arabia. And now Biden went over there and basically apologized for being an idiot. Some of the stuff he did with the oil policy, I think, was kind of short-sighted. But whatever, he wanted to get reelected for his party. But the point is there's the political element there. And you need to understand that that oligopoly has a political element. They have a lot of power. But the U.S. has power, too, because Saudi Arabia, we supply them with arms. And we could also do a lot of damage to them if we wanted to, but we're not going to. You know, they have an upper hand over us in many ways. That being said, they're not stupid. They're smart. They have a long-term plan for oil. But the point is that allows them to fix prices. So as a monopoly, by default, with one carrier, you have a price fixing because there's only one price. There is no second price. If you have the other end of the spectrum for monopoly is what you call an efficient market, which is you have an infinite amount of companies, small companies that are all making very little, if any, profit. So the way the economics works is if you have monopoly, you could have huge profit because you can charge whatever you want. You could build in a fat profit yourself. If you have 10 million companies all doing the same thing, they can squeak out a penny profit because that's all they can squeak out, because any less, it wouldn't be worth doing anymore. Someone else will grab that extra profit. Margin it down to close to zero profit. That's an efficient market. That's where, as a consumer, you're getting your best price. Now, in the middle, there's usually where it gets messy and markets are, right? So technically, there's only one Facebook, but there's some other social media companies. They're not quite the same, but there's only one Google. Well, technically, there's more, but they have like 86% of market share of search, even though technically Bing exists and some of these other carriers. So you've got these messy middle kind of things. Now, an oligopoly, in this case, what this YouTube listener was asking was, what to do against price fixing about oligopolies? Well, there's not much you can do. Government is really the only solution, because government has effectively either allowed a monopoly. Think of utilities. You have a utility company. There's only one. You don't have a choice of more than one. Well, there's a reason for that, because if you had more than one, then there wouldn't be economic value for them to do it so that they don't do it. So that the way that the government manages the monopoly is they have to apply for price raises. So if you're going to raise the electricity prices, they have to apply and get approved by the government to do that. They have to go through this whole process. Now, if their inputs are higher, so they work together to say, all right, we're going to make 5% profit a year, which is why utilities aren't attractive, because you're making 5% a year and who cares? As an investor, it doesn't really matter. But that's how a government manages a monopoly. Now, an oligopoly is in a sense very similar. The government sometimes will allow it, but they also try to keep them in line. So think of operating systems. We've got Windows, for Microsoft is the biggest. You also have Apple's OS. Then you have a few others. The few others are smaller. But the reason you don't have 100 of them is because, Doug, if you and I are sending an email back and forth and we have different computers and we're using different software, we can't communicate. So we need to have the same software that blends together. Now you have Google Drive and you've got their docs and all that. And now you got Microsoft with their suite. So you've got these suites that it's going to be easier and easier to communicate. But the point is you don't have 100 of them. So the point of the question was, how does it contribute to inflation? Let me answer that and I'll let Doug get to it. So the reason it contributes to inflation is because unless it's positioned right with an oligopoly, then these people can raise prices and they could just do whatever they want. So OPEC can virtually just decide, hey, screw you guys, we're going to raise prices. We like Russia better than you. And by the way, we have like 70-80% of the Earth's oil coming out of these countries. So go pound sand and go figure out your own oil. Well, that's going to be a problem for us. Remember the 70s when we had the price spikes? I don't know. It smells very similar to the 70s now, Doug, doesn't it? Where you had those price spikes and you had the OPEC, for all intents and purposes, saying, sorry, you can go pound sand and go sit in your gas lines waiting for gas every other week. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it smells very similar to what happened then. If you think about how that contributes to inflation, it can contribute immensely. So going to war with Ukraine, having higher oil prices. Now, the funny thing is most people think that we have higher oil prices because of Ukraine. No, we didn't. Maybe people need to go back to the Mandela effect and check their memory. It was actually higher before we went to war. We had a little spike, but now it's back down. It was higher before the Ukraine war happened. So before you think that that war is what contributed, it didn't. It very briefly contributed. It may long-term contribute to it, but right now it's not. There's so much else going on in the oil market. What's really contributing to it, by the way, is our terrible carbon policy we have in the U.S., where we're trying to bastardize these energy producers so that they don't invest in CapEx, they don't reinvest their money into new wells, so that our oil prices and our gas prices are going to shoot through the roof for the next 10 years, and people are going to be complaining, those damn oil companies, they make profits on it. No, it's not them. It's the politicians. Mark my words, right now, the politicians are the ones that are causing the price spikes 5 to 10 years from now. And if you think I'm saying hyperbole, I'm not. What we need is a good policy, not a anti-carbon policy. We need a transition plan that makes sense. You can't say everybody needs to have electric cars and not have electric cars for everybody, because that's effectively what our politicians are doing. They're saying everyone needs electric cars tomorrow. Oh, by the way, we don't have enough electric cars for everybody. Oh, and even if we did, we don't have enough electricity to charge them all. But yes, we need to do that. That's effectively
sounds like bullwhip effect for electric cars there, Kirk.
Well, you just saw Tesla just dropped their electric car prices, and so have others. We talked about this a few weeks ago, right? The car price, used car prices are going to plummet. They went down a lot, and now they're starting to go up again. So you can't look at the world in a binary way. The world is not black or white. It is just a lot of shades of gray that you have to try to figure out as you go through it. And I got a follow-up question. Two oil companies in the country is an oligopoly. Yes. If you have more than one, technically, it's an oligopoly. I don't know where that line is, 5 or 10. But the point is, when you have a small group of people who can dictate the price, that's an oligopoly. And once you get past that, once it gets in the competitive market, actually, it's better. But yeah, you have to have government oversight. And I'm not a pro-government guy, but there's really no other way to do it other than government oversight, unless you want every single person in the country to say, we're going to stop driving cars. That's not going to happen. You can't get 10 people in a room to agree. How are you going to get a whole country to agree on something like that? So anyway, thanks for the question, B. Appreciate it. Doug, what are your thoughts? I'm going to take off my tinfoil hat now. My head's starting to sweat.
I had a million thoughts along that. I have forgotten more than I probably thought of. You know, you were talking about, you know, getting computers, not being able to talk. I mean, that's the reality right now with these things, cell phones. Apple has certain ways that you can message through it. And then, of course, you know, if someone's on an Android, they can't get certain features of that text string. If they're trying to do AirDrop, there's a monopoly. Get you into our phone, you can AirDrop. Well, you can't use the Samsung or the Galaxy Android to AirDrop with that. You talk about the oil pricing. Put that hat back on if you want. But we go back 5-6 years ago, I'm from Ohio originally. Don't know where that came from. I think I saw the back of my phone. But here's the thing. The United States was producing rapidly the most oil in the world, and it plummeted oil prices. Again, because it created a bullwhip effect of so much supply out there against demand. COVID came along. COVID dried up production. So all of a sudden it plummeted oil prices even more because now you still have that supply. But what did it also do, Kirk? It drove a lot of the wildcatters out of business. In a very short period of time, those that were doing oil exploration, the Balkans, dried up. People that were looking for new oil in Texas, dried up. All of a sudden, COVID releases and all these factories start up again. And guess what they need? Energy. And when they need all that energy, it sucks the supply of energy out. But guess who is the only ones remaining? OPEC. So guess who's got everybody under their control? De Beers. There's another great example of a monopoly. They control diamond prices, almost 100% of the mines in the world. And they do that to keep their prices exactly where they want them. AT&T. There's plenty of examples of monopolies and oligopolies that are out there. You talked about free market commodities being the absolute best price you can get when the masses dictate how much they're willing to spend against the prices that are being set against what's going to be the price of what's available. But guess what? That so rarely happens. The agricultural market is probably the most commoditized market out there, but yet we still have governments stepping in to provide subsidies for things like paying tobacco farmers not to raise tobacco. This is happening to get people out of smoking. So they're literally paying money to keep the price of tobacco up for these tobacco farmers because they don't want to see the market shift collapse the entire economy for these people. And so what happens a lot of times is even when we try to get into a free market economy, regulations start to come in to protect. That's where special interest groups come in to say, well, if you do this, you're going to hurt us. So then they step up and they do certain things and regulation that takes away from true free market practices. Because I hate to say it, but under free market practices, there will be some bodies left behind. When things shift, things got to shift with it. But we continue to keep certain things supported in order to prevent something uncomfortable happening. And unfortunately, that prevents us from truly being able to get pricing where it should need to be when we evolve on the types of commodities and things that we produce. So not only do you have those that are controlling it, government involvement also controls it. I live in Minnesota. They just passed a law, 2040, we're going to carbon free. People have already been watching the same regulation being passed in California. So what's that going to mean for energy? We have third world countries who have come out and said, we will not be able to afford to have the energy for our countries to become a developed country if you force us into only selecting what you consider to be clean energy. You and I have talked about this before. We all want a planet that is not polluted dust of poor decisions and poor energy. But guess what? If we just cut it off and say, sorry, those options are no longer available, we have created a bullwhip effect because the supply of what is available in green energy is not able to meet the demands that we're being forced through regulation to jump into, which ultimately means that massive inflation. The cars will be expensive. The energy will be expensive. There's only so much to go around, and an unwillingness through regulatory idealism to be able to walk away from energy sources that are there. So maybe, Kirk, maybe fusion's coming. Cross your fingers. But I don't think that that's coming anytime soon, because I don't know about you, but I've heard about hydrogen fuel cells now for 25 years, and they're still not affordable, and they're still not there. And now we're running off batteries, and that's a whole different story. So big tangent there on oligopolies and monopolies and regulation, but it's just something we have to deal with. And again, like I said before, it's out of our control. It's out of your control. We have to make decisions day to day based on what we can control. Otherwise, it'll drive you crazy.
I couldn't agree more, Doug. So we're going to get close to wrapping it up here. We're going to bring it for landing. I want to show two more charts here before we go, just in the spirit of the inflation conversation. So this chart right here is looking at basically food inflation in the world. This is global food inflation. I point this out because just like we have inflation, deflation at the same time, globally, there is higher and lower inflation in certain areas. So if you look at this map, I mean, we're in the 5 to 30% for most of the world, but you've got some pockets that are above 30% food inflation. You certainly have some pockets that are less, although not many. I would say it looks like China and India and Saudi Arabia and a few others, but most of the world is in the 5 to 30, which I would argue is probably accurate. So the one thing to think about is that Doug was talking about a lot of these policies that people want, that politicians want for the world, and trying to dictate to poor countries that they need to have a better energy policy. And they're saying, well, you destroyed the world for 100 years and now you want us to suffer because of it. And I think one of the problems that people have with policy, and I think this goes true. So those of you who believe in climate change, global warming, and those of you who don't, and I'm not going to take a side here, but there are basically two sides to the issue. I think one of the challenges that people who, it's not that they don't believe in it, is that they don't like being told what to do. They don't want to be told by a hypocrite, you need to do that. Now, I live in the state of Massachusetts. We have a lot of what we call limousine liberals around here, or NIMBY liberals, which is, oh, this is all good for you, but I'm not going to do that. Oh, wind energy is great, but don't put it off my house in Nantucket because it's going to destroy my view. It's that kind of a thing. There's one part which I remember once we were talking to a guy who was building wind turbines. And he went to the state of Massachusetts and said, hey, I want to create like 100 new green jobs in your state. Massachusetts is like, go pound sand. They were looking for basically like tax credits or something to like bring jobs. And the state's like, we don't want your jobs. Go pound sand. So he went up to New Hampshire and created green jobs in New Hampshire. And it was great. The point is there's a lot of hypocrisy out there and it has nothing to do with the issue. So what I think a lot of people object to is these billionaires flying around in their private jets and saying, you need to clean the energy and get rid of carbon in the air. Like, okay, why don't you take coach with everybody else, you hypocrite? And I think that's what people object to. And there's no leading by example in the political realm or for the most part in the billionaire realm. There's just not a lot of leadership by example. And I think if we had more leadership by example, you might get more headway. But all these hypocrites out there walking around saying, you need to do what I say, not what I do. Everybody's like, go pound sand. I don't need your app. So the point is get back to inflation. This is obviously a real problem. I do want to get into this one topic because I saw this out there and I wanted to really hit on it, which is this is a chart of global poverty. So in the 1800s, 80% of the world lived in poverty. And now it's probably closer to 10%. Now, the reason I bring this up, because I thought it was interesting, is people always rail against capitalism. Capitalism's bad. Really? Because this looks like capitalism's a good thing. And obviously, you could say there's a lot of bad parts about capitalism, but I really love this chart because it really shows the impact over many, many years, decades, hundreds of years of how capitalism's impact has impacted the world. Yeah, sure, it's not perfect. There's no better system. It's the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry, for sure. But it certainly has obviously proven to be a positive for the rest of the world. So these people walk around and say, oh, socialism's the answer. I'm like, yeah, all that does is create more poverty. As we've seen in every country that's had, you know, socialism, communism has had more poverty. And if you want poverty, then it's a great system because the people at the top, they get all the money, they get all the wealth, they get all the food. Everyone at the bottom, they're starving. And that's what it turns into. We're getting into this realm. Things are cleaning up a little bit, but we're still in this area where people are really agitated at each other and they're picking targets and capitalism's an obvious target. And I think people just need to understand visually the impact of capitalism. And somebody who's running around with their iPhone and their Nike sneakers claiming that death to rich people, it's like, well, like, where'd you get the money for that? Like, you're obviously not poor. We all need to bring a different perspective to our investments, to our life, to our personal finance, and to our world, and just open our minds to the idea that things are not black and white. So that's really what I wanted to end on. This was a great episode. I really appreciate coming on, Doug. Where can people find more about you?
Kirk, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I just want to add on to kind of what you just said there about poverty. There's been some real data that's put out over the years by some of the carriers, just kind of looking at data. People talk about conflict. We're at each other's throats. Social media, everything's negative, negative, negative. You can go back and look at similar articles written for millennia, and it looks like the same articles written today. Back in the day, you had Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton shooting each other. There's always been conflict. But if you look at the conflicts around the world, if you look at poverty around the world, if you look at the data of what it's like to live a quality of life, just go watch a period piece on the Vikings sometimes. My wife and I talk about, geez, it'd be hard to live back then. We have a very fortunate world that we live in today. And it's better than it's ever been in history for the ability to live without conflict, live without starvation, live without oppression. It's got a long way to go, but we're on our way and it continues to improve. And this data, I think, helps to show that. Now, where can you find me? Actually, two places. I'm a founder of two different companies, Pro College Planners. So if you want to learn how to get your child into the best college for them, save thousands of dollars doing it, and be able to make sure that they're going to be on the right path to going out of college and thriving in the future, knowing that they're going to be able to stand on their 2 feet. We have an entire process to help them find the right fit college, get those prices down, and pay for it. Secondly, we talked about business owners at the beginning of today. If you are a business owner out there, this economy's probably been more challenging than it has been in recent years to maneuver. We have a 9-step process through our other company, Automatic Business Method, that will help you to identify really quick and easy ways to make your business run more efficiently, allow you to create a business that's going to thrive without you, better work-life balance, better profitability, better valuation. So you can get our free checklist for college and our free checklist for your business. The first one is procollegeplanners.com. And the second one is automaticbusinessmethod.com. Go there, check it out, download those nice free checklists.
That's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube. Check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling any products or services, so do not consider this advice. If you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin. So please send him an email and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle, a fortune teller, or maybe just a licensed financial advisor. I'm one, but as I said earlier, I'm not selling anything, but I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead, and remember, no one will care about your money like you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.